Welcome to this Uvula audio presentation of the Confessions of St. Augustine, Volume 2, Book 2, 1. I must now carry my thoughts back to the abominable things I did in those days, the sins of the flesh that defiled my soul. I do this, my God, not because I love those sins, but so that I may love you. For love of your love, I shall retrace my wicked ways. The memory is bitter, but it will help me to savor your sweetness, the sweetness that does not deceive, but brings real joy, and never fails. For love of your love, I shall retrieve myself from the havoc of disruption that tore me to pieces when I turned away from you, whom I should have sought, and lost myself instead on many a different quest. For as I grew to manhood, I was inflamed with desire for a surfeit of hell's pleasures. Foolhardy as I was, I ran wild with lust that was manifold and rank. In your eyes my beauty vanished, and I was foul to the core. Yet I was pleased with my own condition, and anxious to be pleasing in the eyes of men. 2. I cared nothing but to love and be loved, but my love went beyond the affection of one mind for another, beyond the arc of the bright beam of friendship. Bodily desire, like a morass, an adolescent sex welling up within me, exuded mists that clouded over and obscured my heart, so that I could not distinguish the clear light of true love from the murk of lust. Love and lust together seethed within me. In my tender youth, they swept me away over the precipice of my body's appetites and plunged me into a whirlpool of sin. More and more I angered you, unaware, for I had been deafened by the clank of my chains, the fetters of the death that was my due to punish the pride of my soul. I strayed still farther from you, and you did not restrain me. I was tossed and spilled, floundering in the broiling sea of my fornication. You said no word. How long it was before I learned that you were my true joy. You were silent then, and I went on my way, farther and farther from you, proud in my distress and restless in fatigue, sowing more and more seeds whose only crop was grief. Was there no one to lull my distress, to turn the fleeting beauty of these newfound attractions to good purpose, and set up a goal for their charms, so that the high tide of my youth might have rolled in upon the shore of marriage? The surge might have been calmed and contented by the procreation of children, which is the purpose of marriage as your law prescribes, O Lord. By this means you form the offspring of our fallen nature, and with a gentle hand you prune back the thorns that have no place in your paradise. For your almighty power is not far from us, even when we are far from you. Or, again, I might have listened more attentively to your voice from the clouds, saying of those who marry that they will meet with outward distress, but I leave you your freedom. That a man does well to abstain from all commerce with women, and that he who is unmarried is concerned with God's claim, asking how he is to please God, whereas the married man is concerned with the world's claim, asking how he is to please his wife. These were the words to which I should have listened with more care, and if I had made myself a eunuch for love of the kingdom of heaven, I should have awaited your embrace with all the greater joy. But instead, I was in a ferment of wickedness. I deserted you and allowed myself to be carried away by the sweep of the tide. I broke all your lawful bounds and did not escape your lash, for what man can escape it? You were always present, angry and merciful at once, strewing the pangs of bitterness over all my lawless pleasures to lead me on to look for others unallied with pain. You meant me to find them nowhere but in yourself, O Lord, for you teach us by inflicting pain. You smite so that you may heal, and you kill us so that we may not die away from you. Where was I then, and how far was I banished from the bliss of your house in the 16th year of my life? This was the age at which the frenzy gripped me, and I surrendered myself entirely to lust that your law forbids, but human hearts are not ashamed to sanction. My family made no effort to save me from my fall by marriage. Their only concern was that I should learn how to make a good speech and how to persuade others by my words. Three. In the same year, my studies were interrupted. I had already begun to go to the nearby town of Madura to study literature and the art of public speaking, but I was brought back home while my father, a modest citizen of Thagaste, whose determination was greater than his means, saved up the money to send me farther afield to Carthage. I need not tell all this to you, my God, but in your presence I tell it to my own kind, to those other men, however few, who may perhaps pick up this book. And I tell it so that I and all who read my words may realize the depths from which we are to cry to you. Your ears will surely listen to the cry of a penitent heart which lives the life of faith. No one had anything but praise for my father, who, despite his slender resources, was ready to provide his son with all that was needed to enable him to travel so far for the purpose of study. Many of our townsmen, far richer than my father, went to no such trouble for their children's sake. Yet this same father of mine took no trouble at all to see how I was growing in your sight, or whether I was chaste or not. He cared only that I should have a fertile tongue, leaving my heart to bear none of your fruits, my God, though you are the only master, true and good, of its husbandry. In the meanwhile, during my 16th year, the narrow means of my family obliged me to leave school and live idly at home with my parents. The brambles of lust grew high above my head, and there was no one to root them out, certainly not my father. One day at the public baths, he saw the signs of active virility coming to life in me, and this was enough to make him relish the thought of having grandchildren. He was happy to tell my mother about it, for this happiness was due to the intoxication that causes the world to forget you, its creator, and to love the things you have created instead of loving you, because the world is drunk with the invisible wine of its own perverted, earthbound will. But in my mother's heart you had already begun to build your temple and laid the foundations of your holy dwelling, while my father was still a catechumen, and a new one at that. So in her piety she became alarmed and apprehensive, and although I had not yet been baptized, she began to dread that I might follow in the crooked path of those who do not keep their eyes on you, but turn their backs instead. How presumptuous it was of me to say that you were silent, my God, when I drifted farther and farther away from you. Can it be true that you said nothing to me at that time? Surely the words that rang in my ears, spoken by your faithful servant, my mother, could have come from none but you. Yet none of them sank into my heart to make me do as you said. I well remember what her wishes were, and how she most earnestly warned me not to commit fornication, and above all, not to seduce any man's wife. It all seemed womanish advice to me, and I should have blushed to accept it. Yet the words were yours, though I did not know it. I thought that you were silent and that she was speaking, but all the while you were speaking to me through her, and when I disregarded her, your handmaid, I was disregarding you, though I was both her son and your servant. But I did this unawares, and continued headlong on my way. I was so blind to the truth that among my companions I was ashamed to be less dissolute than they were, for I heard them bragging of their depravity, and the greater the sin, the more they gloried in it. So I took pleasure in the same vices, not only for the enjoyment of what I did, but also for the applause I won. Nothing deserves to be despised more than vice. Yet I gave in more and more to vice, simply in order not to be despised. If I had not sinned enough to rival other sinners, I used to pretend that I had done things I hadn't done at all, because I was afraid that innocence would be taken for cowardice and chastity for weakness. These were the companions with whom I walked the streets of Babylon. I wallowed in its mire as if it were made of spices and precious ointments. And to fix me all the faster in the very depths of sin, the unseen enemy trod me underfoot and enticed me to himself because I was an easy prey for his seductions. For even my mother, who by now had escaped from the center of Babylon, though she still loitered in its outskirts, did not act upon what she had heard about me from her husband with the same earnestness as she had advised me about chastity. She saw I was already infected with a disease that would become dangerous later on. But if the growth of my passions could not be cut back to the quick, she did not think it right to restrict them to the bounds of married love. This was because she was afraid that the bonds of marriage might be a hindrance to my hopes for the future, not, of course, the hope of the life to come, which she reposed in you, but my hopes of success at my studies. Both my parents were unduly eager for me to learn. My father, because he gave next to no thought to you, and only shallow thought to me, and my mother, because she thought that the usual course of study would certainly not hinder me, but would even help me in my approach to you. To the best of my memory, this is how I construe the characters of my parents. Furthermore, I was given a free rein to amuse myself beyond the strict limits of discipline, so that I lost myself in many kinds of evil ways, in all of which a pall of darkness hung between me and the bright light of your truth, my God. What malice proceeded from my pampered heart. 4. It is certain, O Lord, that theft is punished by your law, the law that is written in men's hearts and cannot be erased, however sinful they are. For no thief can bear that another thief should steal from him, even if he is rich and the other is driven by want. Yet I was willing to steal, and steal I did, although I was not compelled by any lack, unless it was a lack of sense of justice, or a distaste for what was right, and a greedy love of doing wrong. For of what I stole, I already had plenty, and much better at that, and I had no wish to enjoy the things I coveted by stealing, but only to enjoy the theft itself. There was a pear tree near our vineyard, loaded with fruit, that was attractive neither to look at nor to taste. Late one night, a band of ruffians, myself included, went off to shake down the fruit and carry it away, for we had continued our games out of doors until well after dark, as was our pernicious habit. We took away an enormous quantity of pears, not to eat for ourselves, but simply to throw to the pigs. Perhaps we ate some of them, but our real pleasure consisted in doing something that was forbidden. Look into my heart, O God, the same heart on which you took pity when it was in the depths of the abyss. Let my heart now tell you what prompted me to do wrong for no purpose, and why it was only my own love of mischief that made me do it. The evil in me was foul, but I loved it. I loved my own perdition and my own faults. Not the things for which I committed wrong, but the wrong itself. My soul was vicious and broke away from your safe keeping to seek its own destruction, looking for no profit in disgrace, but only for disgrace itself. 5. The eye is attracted by beautiful objects, by gold and silver and all such things. There is great pleasure, too, in feeling something agreeable to the touch, and material things have various qualities to please each of the other senses. Again, it is gratifying to be held in esteem by other men, and to have the power of giving them orders and gaining mastery over them. This is also the reason why revenge is sweet. But our ambition to obtain all these things must not lead us astray from you, O Lord, nor must we depart from what your law allows. The life we live on earth has its own attractions as well, because it has a certain beauty of its own in harmony with all the rest of this world's beauty. Friendship among men, too, is a delightful bond, uniting many souls in one. All these things and their like can be occasions of sin, because, good though they are of the lowest order of good. And if we are too much tempted by them to abandon those higher and better things, your truth, your law, and you yourself, O Lord our God. For these earthly things too can give joy, though not such joy as my God, who made them all, can give, because honest men will rejoice in the Lord. Upright hearts will not boast in vain. When there is an inquiry to discover why a crime has been committed, normally no one is satisfied until it has been shown that the motive might have been either the desire of gaining or the fear of losing, one of those good things which I said were of the lowest order. For such things are attractive and have beauty, although they are paltry trifles in comparison with the worth of God's blessed treasures. A man commits murder, and we ask the reason. He did it because he wanted his victim's wife or estates for himself, or so that he might live on the proceeds of robbery, or because he was afraid that the other might defraud him of something, or because he had been wronged and was burning for revenge. Surely no one would believe that he would commit murder for no reason but the sheer delight of killing? Sallust tells us that Catiline was a man of insane ferocity, who chose to be cruel and vicious without apparent reason. But we are also told that his purpose was not to allow his men to lose heart or to waste their skill through lack of practice. If we ask the reason for this, it's obvious that he meant that once he had made himself master of the government by means of this continual violence, he would obtain honor, power, and wealth, and would no longer go in fear of the law because of his crimes, or have to face difficulties through lack of funds. So even Catiline did not love crime for crime's sake. He loved something quite different, for the sake of which he committed his crimes. 6. If the crime of theft that I committed that night as a boy of 16 were a living thing, I could speak to it and ask what it was that, to my shame, I loved in it. It had no beauty because it was robbery. It is true that the pears that we stole had beauty because they were created by you, the good God, who are the most beautiful of all beings and the creator of all things, the supreme good and my own true good. But it was not the pears that my unhappy soul desired. I had plenty of my own, better than those, and I only picked them so that I might steal. For no sooner had I picked them than I threw them away, and tasted nothing in them but my own sin, that I relished and enjoyed. If any part of one of those pears passed my lips, it was the sin that gave it flavor. And now, O Lord my God, now that I ask what pleasure I had in that theft, I find that it had no beauty to attract me. I do not mean the beauty of the sort that justice and prudence possess, nor the beauty that in man's mind and in his memory and in the life that animates him, nor the beauty of the stars in their allotted places, or of the earth and sea, teeming with new life born to replace the old as it passes away. It did not even have the shadowy, deceptive beauty that makes the vice attractive. Pride, for instance, which is a pretense of superiority, imitating yours, for you alone are God, supreme over all. Or ambition, which is only a craving for honor and glory, when you alone are to be honored before all, and you alone are glorious forever. Cruelty is the weapon of the powerful, used to make others fear them. Yet no one is to be feared but God alone, from whose power nothing can be snatched away or stolen by any man, or at any time, or place, or by any means. The lustful use caresses to win the love they crave for. Yet no caress is sweeter than your charity, and no love more rewarding than the love of your truth, which shines in beauty above all else. Inquisitiveness has all the appearance of a thirst for knowledge, yet you have supreme knowledge of all things. Ignorance, too, and stupidity choose to go under the mask of simplicity and innocence, because you are simplicity itself, and no innocence is greater than yours. You are innocent even of the harm which overtakes the wicked, for it is the result of their own actions. Sloth poses as the love of peace. Yet what certain peace is there besides the Lord? Extravagance masquerades as fullness and abundance, but you are the full, unfailing store of never-dying sweetness. The spendthrift makes a pretense of liberality, but you are the most generous dispenser of all good. The covetous want many possessions for themselves, yet you possess all. The envious struggle for preferment, but what is to be preferred before you? Anger demands revenge, but what vengeance is as just as yours? Fear shrinks from any sudden unwanted danger which threatens the thing that it loves, for its only care is safety. But to you nothing is strange, nothing is unforeseen. No one can part you from the things that you love, and safety is assured nowhere but in you. Grief eats away its heart for the loss of things that it took pleasure in desiring, because it wants to be like you, from whom nothing can be taken away. So the soul defiles itself with unchaste love when it turns away from you and looks elsewhere for things which it cannot find pure and unsullied except by returning to you. All who desert you and set themselves up against you merely copy you in a perverse way. By this very act of imitation, they only show that you are the creator of all nature, and consequently there is no place whatever where man may hide away from you. What was it then that pleased me in the act of theft? Which of my Lord's powers did I imitate in a perverse and wicked way? Since I had no real power to break his law, was it that I enjoyed at least the pretense of doing so? Like a prisoner who creates for himself the illusion of liberty by doing something wrong, when he has no fear of punishment under a feeble hallucination of power? Here was the slave who ran away from his master and chased a shadow instead. What an abomination! What a parody of life! What abysmal death! Could I enjoy doing what was wrong for no other reason than that it was simply wrong? 7. What return shall I make to the Lord for my ability to recall those things with no fear in my soul? I will love you, Lord, and thank you and praise your name because you have forgiven me such great sins and such wicked deeds. I acknowledge that it was by your grace and mercy that you melted away my sins like ice. I acknowledge, too, that by your grace I was preserved from whatever sins I did not commit, for there was no knowing what I might have done, since I loved evil, even if it served no purpose. I avow that you have forgiven me all, but the sins which I committed of my own accord, and those which by your guidance I was spared from committing. What man who reflects upon his own weakness can dare to claim that his own efforts have made him chaste and free from sin, as though this entitled him to love you the less, on the grounds that he had less need of the mercy by which you forgive the sins of the penitent? There are some who have been called by you because they have listened to your voice. They have avoided the sins that I here record and confess for them to read. But let them not deride me for having been cured by the same doctor who preserved them from sickness, or at least from such grave sickness as mine. Let them love you just as much, or even more than I do, for they can see that the same healing hand that rid me of the great fever of my sins protects them from falling sick of the same disease. 8. It brought me no happiness, for what harvest did I reap from acts which now make me blush, particularly from the act of theft? I loved nothing in it except the thieving, though I cannot truly speak of that as a thing that I could love. And I was only the more miserable because of it. And yet, as I recall my feelings at the time, I am quite sure that I would not have done it on my own. Was it then that I also enjoyed the company of those with whom I committed the crime? If this is so, there was something else I loved besides the act of theft. But I cannot call it something else, because companionship, like theft, is nothing at all. No one can tell me the truth of it except my God, who enlightens my mind and dispels its shadows. What conclusion am I trying to reach from these questions and this discussion? It is true that if the pears that I stole had been to my taste, and if I had wanted to get them for myself, I might have committed the crime on my own if I had needed to do no more than that to win myself the pleasure. I should have had no need to kindle my glowing desire by rubbing shoulders with a gang of accomplices. But as it was not the fruit that gave me the pleasure, I must have got it from the crime itself, and from the thrill of having partners in sin. 9. How can I explain my mood? It was certainly a very vile frame of mind, and one for which I suffered. But how can I account for it? Who knows his own frailties? We were tickled to laughter by the prank we played, because no one suspected us of it, although the owners were furious. Why was it, then, that I thought it fun not to have been the only culprit? Perhaps it was because we do not easily laugh when we are alone. True enough, but even when a man is all by himself and quite alone, sometimes he cannot help laughing if he thinks or hears or sees something especially funny. All the same, I am quite sure that I would never have done this thing on my own. My God, I lay all this before you, for it is still alive in my memory. By myself, I would not have committed that robbery. It was not the taking that attracted me, but the raid itself. And yet to do it by myself would have been no fun, and I should not have done it. This was friendship of a most unfriendly sort, bewitching my mind in an inexplicable way. For the sake of a laugh, a little sport, I was glad to do harm and anxious to damage another, and that without thought of profit for myself or retaliation for injuries received. And all because we are ashamed to hold back when others say, "Come on, let's do it." 10. Can anyone unravel this twisted tangle of knots? I shudder to look at it or think of such abomination. I long instead for innocence and justice, graceful and splendid, in eyes whose sight is undefiled. My longing fills me, and yet it cannot cloy. With them is certain peace in life that cannot be disturbed. The man who enters their domain goes to share the joy of his Lord. He shall know no fear and shall lack no good. In him that is goodness itself, he shall find his own best way of life. But I deserted you, my God. In my youth I wandered away, too far from your sustaining hand, and created of myself a barren waste. End of Book 2. Book 3. 1. I went to Carthage, where I found myself in the midst of a hissing cauldron of lust. I had not yet fallen in love, but I was in love with the idea of love. And this feeling that something was missing made me despise myself for not being more anxious to satisfy the need. I began to look around for some object for my love, since I badly wanted to love something. I had no liking for the safe path without pitfalls, for although my real need was for you, my God, who are the food of the soul, I was not aware of this hunger. I felt no need for the food that does not perish. Not because I had my fill of it, but because the more I was starved of it, the less palatable it seemed. Because of this, my soul fell sick. It broke out in ulcers, and looked about desperately for some material worldly means of relieving the itch that they caused. But material things, which have no soul, could not be true objects for my love. To love and to have my love returned was my heart's desire, and it would be all the sweetest if I could enjoy the body of the one who loved me. So I muddled the stream of friendship with the filth of lewdness, and clouded its clear waters with hell's black river of lust. And yet, in spite of this rank depravity, I was vain enough to have ambitions of cutting a fine figure in the world. I also fell in love, which was a snare of my own choosing. My God of mercy, how good you were to me, for you mixed such bitterness in that cup of pleasure. My love was returned and finally shackled me in the bonds of its consummation. In the midst of my joy, I was caught up in the coils of trouble, for I was lashed with the cruel, fiery rods of jealousy and suspicion, fear, anger, and quarrels. 2. I was much attracted by the theater because the plays reflected my own unhappy plight and were tender to my fire. Why is it that men enjoy feeling sad at the sight of tragedy and suffering on the stage, although they would be most unhappy if they had to endure the same fate themselves? Yet they watch the plays because they hope to be made to feel sad, and that feeling of sorrow is what they enjoy. What miserable delirium this is! The more a man is subject to such suffering himself, the more easily he is moved by it in the theater. Yet when he suffers himself, we call it misery. When he suffers out of sympathy with others, we call it pity. But what sort of pity can we really feel for an imaginary scene on a stage? The audience is not called upon to offer help, but only to feel sorrow. And the more they are pained, the more they applaud the author. Whether this human agony is based on fact or simply imaginary, if it's acted so badly that the audience is not moved to sorrow, they leave the theater in a disgruntled and critical mood. Whereas if they are made to feel pain, they stay to the end watching happily. This shows that sorrow and tears can be enjoyable. Of course, everyone wants to be happy, but even if no one likes being sad, is there just the one exception that because we enjoy pitying others, we welcome their misfortunes, without which we could not pity them? If so, it is because friendly feelings well up in us like the waters of a spring. But what course do these waters follow? Where do they flow? Why do they trickle away to join that stream of boiling pitch, the hideous flood of lust? For, by their own choice, they lose themselves and become absorbed in it. They are diverted from their true course and deprived of their original heavenly calm. Of course, this does not mean that we must arm ourselves against compassion. There are times when we must welcome sorrow on behalf of others. But for the sake of our souls, we must beware of uncleanliness. My God must be the keeper of my soul, the God of our fathers, who is to be exalted and extolled forevermore. My soul must guard against uncleanliness. I am not nowadays insensible to pity, but in those days I used to share the joy of stage lovers and their sinful pleasure in each other, even though it was all done in make-believe for the sake of entertainment. And when they parted, pity of a sort led me to share their grief. I enjoyed these emotions equally, but now I feel more pity for a man who is happy in his sins than for one who has to endure the ordeal of foregoing some harmful pleasure or being deprived of some enjoyment that was really an affliction. Of the two, this sort of pity is certainly the more genuine, but the sorrow that it causes is not a source of pleasure. For although a man who is sorry for the sufferings of others deserves praise for his charity, nonetheless, if his pity is genuine, he would prefer that there should be no cause for his sorrow. If the impossible could happen, and kindness was unkind, a man whose sense of pity was true and sincere might want others to suffer so that he could pity them. Sorrow may therefore be commendable, but never desirable, for it is powerless to stab you, Lord God, and this is why the love you bear for our souls and the compassion you show for them are pure and unalloyed, far purer than the love and pity that we feel ourselves. But who can prove himself worthy of such a calling? However, in those unhappy days, I enjoyed the pangs of sorrow. I always looked for things to wring my heart, and the more tears an actor caused me to shed by his performance on the stage, even though he was portraying the imaginary distress of others, the more delightful and attractive I found it. Was it any wonder that I, the unhappy sheep who strayed from your flock, impatient for your shepherding, became infected with a loathsome mange? Hence my love of things that made me sad. I did not seek the kind of sorrow that would wound me deeply, for I had no wish to endure the sufferings that I saw on the stage. But I enjoyed fables and fictions that could only graze the skin. But where the fingers scratch, the skin becomes inflamed. It swells and festers with hideous pus. And the same happened to me. Could the life I led be called true life, my God? 3. Yet all the while, far above, your mercy hovered faithfully about me. I exhausted myself in depravity, in the pursuit of an unholy curiosity. I deserted you and sank to the bottommost depths of skepticism and mockery of devil worship. My sins were a sacrifice to the devil. For all of them you chastised me. I defied you even so far as to relish the thought of lust, and gratify it too, within the walls of your church during the celebration of your mysteries. For such a deed I deserved to pluck the fruit of death, and you punished me for it with a heavy lash. But compared with my guilt, the penalty was nothing. How infinite is your mercy, my God! You are my refuge from the terrible dangers amongst which I wandered, head on high, intent upon withdrawing still further from you. I loved my own way, not yours, but it was a truant's freedom that I loved. Besides these pursuits, I was also studying for the law. Such ambition was held to be honorable, and I determined to succeed in it. The more scrupulous I was, the greater my reputation was likely to be. For men are so blind that they even take pride in their blindness. By now I was at the top of the school of rhetoric. I was pleased with my superior status, and swollen with conceit. All the same, as you well know, Lord, I behaved far more quietly than the wreckers, a title of ferocious devilry that the fashionable set chose for themselves. I had nothing whatever to do with their outbursts of violence, but I lived amongst them, feeling a perverse sense of shame because I was not like them. I kept company with them, and there were times when I found their friendship a pleasure, but I always had a horror of what they did when they lived up to their name. Without provocation, they would set upon some timid newcomer, gratuitously affronting his sense of decency for their own amusement, and using it as fodder for their spiteful jests. This was the devil's own behavior, or not far different. Wreckers was a fit name for them, for they were already adrift and total wrecks themselves. The mockery and trickery that they loved to practice on others was a secret snare of the devil, by which they mocked and tricked themselves. 4. These were the companions with whom I studied the art of eloquence at an impressionable age. It was my ambition to be a good speaker, for the unhallowed and inane purpose of gratifying human vanity. The prescribed course of study brought me to a work of an author named Cicero, whose writing nearly everyone admires, if not the spirit of it. The title of the book is Hortensius, and it recommends the reader to study philosophy. It altered my outlook on life. It changed my prayers to you, O Lord, and provided me with new hopes and aspirations. All my empty dreams suddenly lost their charm, and my heart began to throb with a bewildering passion for the wisdom of eternal truth. I began to climb out of the depths to which I had sunk in order to return to you, for I did not use the book as a whetstone to sharpen my tongue. It was not the style of it, but the contents that won me over. And yet the allowance that my mother paid me was supposed to be spent on putting an edge on my tongue. I was now in my 19th year, and she supported me, because my father had died 2 years before. My God, how I burned with longing to have wings to carry me back to you, away from all earthly things, although I had no idea what you would do with me, for yours is the wisdom. In Greek, the word philosophy means love of wisdom, and it was with this love that Hortensius inflamed me. There are people for whom philosophy is a means of misleading others, for they misuse its great name, its attractions, and its intensity to give color and gloss to their own errors. Most of these so-called philosophers who lived in Cicero's time and before are noted in the book. He shows them up in their true colors and makes quite clear how wholesome is the admonition that the Holy Spirit gives in the words of your good and true servant Paul. Take not to let anyone cheat you with his philosophizings, with empty fantasies drawn from human tradition, from worldly principles. They were never Christ's teaching. In Christ, the whole plenitude of deity is embodied and dwells in him. But, O light of my heart, you know that at that time, although Paul's words were not known to me, the only thing that pleased me in Cicero's book was his advice not simply to admire one or another of the schools of philosophy, but to love wisdom itself, whatever it might be, and to search for it, pursue it, hold it, and embrace it with fire. And the only check to this blaze of enthusiasm was that they made no mention of the name of Christ. For by your mercy, Lord, from the time when my mother fed me at the breast, my infant heart had been suckled dutifully on his name, the name of your Son, my Savior. Deep inside my heart his name remained, and nothing could entirely captivate me, however learned, however neatly expressed, however true it might be, unless his name were in it. 5. So I made my mind up to examine the Holy Scriptures and see what kind of books they were. I discovered something that was at once beyond the understanding of the proud and hidden from the eyes of children. Its gait was humble, but the heights it reached were sublime. It was enfolded in mysteries, and I was not the kind of man to enter into it or bow my head to follow where it led. But these were not the feelings I had when I first read the Scriptures. To me, they seemed quite unworthy of comparison with the stately prose of Cicero. Because I had too much conceit to accept their simplicity and not enough insight to penetrate their depths, it is surely true that as the child grows, these books grow with him. But I was too proud to call myself a child. I was inflated with self-esteem, and that made me think myself a great man. 6. I fell in with a set of sensualists, men with glib tongues who ranted and raved and had the snares of the devil in their mouths. They baited the traps by confusing the syllables of the names of God the Father, God the Son, our Lord Jesus Christ, and God the Holy Ghost, the Paraclete, who comforts us. These names were always on the tips of their tongues, but only as sounds that they mouthed aloud, for in their hearts they had no inkling of the truth. Yet truth and truth alone was the motto that they repeated to me again and again, although the truth was nowhere to be found in them. All that they said was false, both what they said about you, who truly are the truth, and what they said about this world and its first principles, which were your creation. But I ought not to have been content with what the philosophers said about such things, even when they spoke the truth. I should have passed beyond them for love of you, my Supreme Father, my good Father, in whom all beauty has its source. Truth, truth, how the very marrow of my soul within me yearned for it as they dinned it in my ears over and over again. To them it was no more than a name to be voiced or a word to be read in their libraries of huge books. But while my hunger was for you, for truth itself, these were the dishes on which they served me up the sun and moon, beautiful works of yours. But still, your works, not you yourself, not even the greatest of your created things. For your spiritual works are greater than these material things, however brightly they may shine in the sky. But my hunger and thirst were not even for the greatest of your works, but for you, my God, because you are truth itself, with whom there can be no change, no swerving from your course. Yet the dishes they set before me were still loaded with dazzling fantasies, illusions with which the eye deceives the mind. It would have been better to love the sun itself, which at least is real as far as we can see. But I gulped down this food because I thought that it was you, I had no relish for it because the taste it left in my mouth was not the taste of truth. It couldn't be, for it was not you, but an empty sham, and it did not nourish me, but starve me all the more. The food we dream of is very like the food we eat when we are awake, but it does not nourish because it is only a dream. Yet the things they gave me to eat were not in the least like you, as now I know since you have spoken to me. They were dream substances, mock realities, far less true than the real things that we see with the sight of our eyes in the sky, or on earth. These things are seen by bird and beast as well as by ourselves, and they are far more certain than any image we conceive of them. And in turn we can picture them to ourselves with greater certainty than the vaster, infinite things that we surmise from them. Such things have no existence at all, but they were the visionary foods on which I was fed but not sustained. But you, O God, whom I love and on whom I lean in weakness, so that I may be strong, you are not the sun and the moon and the stars, even though we see these bodies in the heavens. Nor are you those other bodies that we do not see in the sky, for you created them, and in your reckoning they are not even among the greatest of your works. How far, then, must you really be from those fantasies of mine, those imaginary material things that do not exist at all? The images we form in our mind's eye when we picture things that do exist are far better founded than these inventions, and the things themselves are still more certain than the images we form of them. But you are not these things. Neither are you the soul, which is the life of bodies, and since it gives them life, must be better and more certain than they are themselves. But you are the life of souls, the life of lives. You live, O life of my soul, because you are life itself, immutable. Where were you in those days? How far away from me? I was wandering far from you, and I was not even allowed to eat the husks on which I fed the swine. For surely the fables of the poets and the penmen are better than the traps which those impostors set. There is certainly more to be gained from verses and poems and tales like the flight of Medea than from their stories of the five elements disguised in various ways because of the five dens of darkness. These things simply do not exist, and they are death to those who believe in them. Verses and poems can provide real food for thought, but although I used to recite verses about Medea's flight through the air, I never maintained that they were true, and I never believed the poems that I heard others recite, but I did believe the tales that these men told. These were the stages of my pitiful fall into the depths of hell, as I struggled and strained for lack of truth. My God, you had mercy on me even before I had confessed to you, but I now confess that all this was because I tried to find you, not through the understanding of the mind, by which you meant us to be superior to the beasts, but through the senses of the flesh. Yet you were deeper than my inmost understanding, and higher than the topmost height that I could reach. I had blundered upon that woman in Solomon's parable, who, ignorant and unabashed, sat at her door and said, "Stolen waters are sweetest, and bread is better eating when there is none to see." She inveigled me because she found me living in the outer world that lay before my eyes, the eyes of the flesh, and dwelling upon the food that they provided for my mind. 7. There is another reality besides this, though I knew nothing of it. My own specious reasoning induced me to give in to the sly arguments of fools who asked me what the origin of evil, whether God was confined to the limits of a bodily shape, whether he had hair and nails, and whether men could be called just if they had more than one wife at the same time, or killed other men, or sacrificed living animals. My ignorance was so great that these questions troubled me, and while I thought I was approaching the truth, I was only departing the further from it. I did not know that evil is nothing but the removal of good, until finally no good remains. How could I see this when with the sight of my eyes I saw no more than material things, and with the sight of my mind no more than their images. I did not know that God is a spirit, a being without bulk and without limbs defined in length and breadth, for bulk is less in the part than in the whole, and if it is infinite, it is less in any part of it, which can be defined within fixed limits, than it is in its infinity. It cannot therefore be everywhere entirely whole, as a spirit is, and as God is. Nor had I the least notion what it is in us that gives us our being, or what the scriptures mean when they say that we are made in God's image. I knew nothing of the true underlying justice that judges not according to convention, but according to the truly equitable law of Almighty God. This is the law by which each age and place forms rules of conduct best suited to itself, although the law itself is always and everywhere the same, and does not differ from place to place or from age to age. I did not see that by the sanction of this law, Abraham and Isaac, Jacob, Moses, David, and the others whom God praised were just men, although they have been reckoned sinners by men who are not qualified to judge, for they try them by human standards, and assess all the rights and wrongs of the human race by the measure of their own customs. Anyone who does this behaves like a man who knows nothing about armor, and cannot tell which piece is meant for which part of the body, so that he tries to cover his head with a shin piece, and fix a helmet to his foot, and then complains because they will not fit, or like a shopkeeper who is allowed to sell his wares in the morning but grumbles because the afternoon is a public holiday and he will not be allowed to trade, or like a man who sees one of the servants in a house handling things which the cellar man is not allowed to touch, or finds something being done in the stable yard which is not allowed in the dining room, and is then indignant because the members of the household, living together in one house, are not all given the same privileges in all parts of the house. The people of whom I am speaking have the same sort of grievance when they hear that things which good men could do without sin in days gone by are not permitted in ours, and that God gave them one commandment and has given us another. He has done this because the times have demanded it, although men were subject to the same justice in those days as we are in these. Yet those who complain about this understand that when we are dealing with a single man, a single day, or a single house, each part of the whole has a different function suited to it. What may be done at one time of the day is not allowed at the next, and what may be done or must be done in one room is forbidden and punished in another. This does not mean that justice is erratic or variable, but that the times over which it presides are not always the same, for it is the nature of time to change. Man's life on earth is short, and he cannot by his own perception see the connection between the conditions of earlier times and of other nations, which he has not experienced himself, and those of his own times, which are familiar to him. But when only one individual, one day, or one house is concerned, he can easily see what is suitable for each part of the whole, and for each member of the household, and what must be done at which times and places. These things he accepts, but with the habits of other ages he finds fault. I knew nothing of this at the time. I was quite unconscious of it, quite blind to it, although it stared me in the face. When I composed verses, I could not fit any foot in any position that I pleased. Each meter was differently scanned, and I could not put the same foot in every position in the same line. And yet the art of poetry by which I composed does not vary from one line to another. It is the same for all alike. But I did not discern that justice, which those good and holy men obeyed, in a far more perfect and sublime way then poetry contains in itself, at one and the same time, all the principles which it prescribes, without discrepancy. Although as times change, it prescribes and apportions them, not all at once, but according to the needs of the times. Blind to this, I found fault with the holy patriarchs, not only because in their own day they acted as God commanded and inspired them, but also because they predicted the future as he revealed it to them. 8. Surely it is never wrong at any time or in any place for a man to love God with his whole heart and his whole soul and his whole mind, and to love his neighbor as himself. Sins against nature, therefore, like the sin of Sodom, are abominable and deserve punishment wherever and whenever they are committed. If all nations committed them, all alike would be held guilty of the same charge of God's law. For our Maker did not prescribe that we should use each other in this way. In fact, the relationship which we ought to have with God is itself violated when our nature, of which he is author, is desecrated by perverted lust. On the other hand, offenses against human codes of conduct vary according to differences of custom, so that no one, whether he is a native or a foreigner, may, to suit his own pleasure, violate the conventions established by the customary usage or law of the community or the state. For any part that is out of keeping with the whole is at fault. But if God commands a nation to do something contrary to its customs or constitutions, it must be done even if it has never been done in that country before. If it is a practice that has been discontinued, it must be resumed. And if it was not a law before, it must be enacted. In his own kingdom, a king has the right to make orders that neither he nor any other has ever made before. Obedience to his orders is not against the common interest of the community. In fact, if they were disobeyed, the common interest would suffer, because it is the general agreement in human communities that the ruler is obeyed. How much more right, then, has God to give commands, since he is the ruler of all creation, and all his creatures must obey his commandments without demur? For all must yield to God, just as in the government of human society, the lesser authority must yield to the greater. With sins of violence, the case is the same as with sins against nature. Here the impulse is to injure others, either by word or by deed. But by whichever means it is done, there are various reasons for doing it. A man may injure his enemy for the sake of revenge. A robber may assault a traveler to secure for himself something that is not his own. Or a man may attack someone whom he fears in order to avoid danger to himself. Or the injury may be done from envy, which will cause an unhappy man to harm another more fortunate than himself, or a rich man to harm someone whose rivalry he fears for the future, or already resents. Again, it may be done for the sheer joy of seeing others suffer, as is the case with those who watch gladiators or make fun of other people or jeer at them. These are the main categories of sin. They are hatched from the lust for power, from gratification of the eye, and from gratification of corrupt nature, from one or two of these, or from all three together. Because of them, O God, most high and most sweet, our lives offend against your 10-stringed harp, your commandments, the 3 which proclaim our duty to you, and the 7 which proclaim our duty to men. But how can sins of vice be against you, since you cannot be marred by perversion? How can sins of violence be against you, since nothing can injure you? Your punishments are for the sins which men commit against themselves, because although they sin against you, they do wrong to their own souls, and their malice is self-betrayed. They corrupt and pervert their own nature, which you made and for which you shape the rules, either by making wrong use of the things which you allow, or by becoming inflamed with passion to make unnatural use of things which you do not allow. Or else their guilt consists in raving against you in their hearts, and with their tongues, and kicking against the goad, or in playing havoc with the restrictions of human society, and brazenly exulting in private feuds and factions, each according to his fancies or his fads. This is what happens, O Fountain of Life, when we abandon you, who are the one true creator of all that ever was or is, and each of us proudly sets his heart on some part of your creation instead of on the whole. So it is by the path of meekness and devotion that we must return to you. You rid us of our evil habits and forgive our sins when we confess to you. You listen to the groans of the prisoners and free us from the chains that we have forged for ourselves. This you do for us unless we toss our head against you in the illusion of liberty and in our greed for gain, and at the risk of losing all, love our own good better than you yourself, who are the common good of all. 9. Among these vices and crimes, and all the endless ways in which men do wrong, there are also the sins of those who follow the right path, but go astray. By the rule of perfection, these lapses are condemned, if we judge them aright, but the sinners may yet be praised, for they give promise of better fruit to come, like the young shoots that later bear the ears of corn. Sometimes we also do things that have every appearance of being sins against nature or against our fellow men, but are not sins because they offend neither you, the Lord, our God, nor the community in which we live. For example, a man may amass a store of goods to meet the needs of life or some contingency, but it does not necessarily follow that he is a miser. Or he may be punished by those whose duty it is to correct misdemeanors, but it is by no means certain that they do it out of wanton cruelty. Many of the things that we do may therefore seem wrong to men, but are approved in the light of your knowledge, and many which men applaud are condemned in your eyes. This is because the appearance of what we do is often different from the intention with which we do it, and the circumstances of the time may not be clear. But when you suddenly command us to do something strange and unforeseen, even if you had previously forbidden it, none can doubt that the command must be obeyed, even though, for the time being, you may conceal the reason for it, and it may conflict with the established rule of custom in some forms of society. For no society is right and good unless it obeys you, but happy are they who know that the commandment was yours. For all that your servants do is done as an example of what is needed for the present, or as a sign of what is yet to come. 10. I was ignorant of this, and derided those holy servants and prophets of yours. But all that I achieved in deriding them was to earn your derision for myself. For I was gradually led to believe such nonsense as that a fig wept when it was plucked, and that the tree which bore it shed tears of mother's milk. But if some sanctified member of the sect were to eat the fig, someone else, of course, would have committed the sin of plucking it, he would digest it and breathe it out again in the form of angels, or even as particles of God, retching them up as he groaned in prayer. These particles of the true and supreme God were supposed to be imprisoned in the fruit, and could only be released by means of the stomach and teeth of one of the elect. I was foolish enough to believe that we should show more kindness to the fruits of the earth than to mankind, for whose use they were intended. If a starving man, not a manichee, were then to beg for a mouthful, they thought it a crime worthy of mortal punishment to give him one. 11. But you sent down your help from above, and rescued my soul from the depths of this darkness, because my mother, your faithful servant, wept to you for me, shedding more tears for my spiritual death than other mothers shed for the bodily death of a son. For in her faith and in the spirit which she had from you, she looked on me as dead. You heard her and did not despise the tears that streamed down and watered the earth in every place where she bowed her head in prayer. You heard her. For how else can I explain the dream with which you consoled her, so that she agreed to live with me and eat at the same table in our home? Lately she had refused to do this, because she loathed and shunned the blasphemy of my false beliefs. She dreamed she was standing on a wooden rule, and coming towards her in a halo of splendor, she saw a young man who smiled at her in joy, although she herself was sad and quite consumed with grief. He asked her the reason for her sorrow and her daily tears, not because he did not know, but because he had something to tell her, for this is what happens in visions. When she replied that her tears were for the soul I had lost, he told her to take heart, for if she looked carefully, she would see that where she was, there also was I. and when she looked, she saw me standing beside her on the same rule. Where could this dream have come from, unless it was that you listened to the prayer of her heart? For your goodness is almighty. You take good care of each of us, as if you had no others in your care, and you look after all as you look after each. And surely it was for the same reason that, when she told me of the dream, and I tried to interpret it as a message, that she need not despair of being one day such as I was then, she said at once, and without hesitation, "No, he did not say, 'Where he is, you are,' but, 'Where you are, he is.'" I now declare to you, Lord, that I was much moved by this answer, which you gave through my mother. She was not disturbed by my interpretation of her dream, plausible though it was, but quickly saw the true meaning, which I had not seen until she spoke. I was more deeply moved by this than by the dream itself, in which the joy for which this devout woman had still so long to wait was foretold so long before to comfort her in the time of her distress. For nearly 9 years were yet to come, during which I wallowed deep in the mire and the darkness of delusion. Often I tried to lift myself, only to plunge the deeper. Yet all the time this chaste, devout, and prudent woman, a widow such as is close to your heart, never ceased to pray at all hours, and to offer you the tears she shed for me. The dream had given new spirit to her hope, but she gave no rest to her sighs and her tears. Her prayers reached your presence, and yet you still left me to twist and turn in the dark. 12. I remember that in the meantime you gave her another answer to her prayers, though there is much besides this that escapes my memory, and much too that I must omit because I am in haste to pass on to other things, which I am more anxious to confess to you. This other answer you gave her through the mouth of one of your priests, a bishop who had lived his life in the church and was well versed in the scriptures. My mother asked him as a favor to have a talk with me so that he might refute my errors, drive the evil out of my mind, and replace it with good. He often did this when he found suitable pupils, but he refused to do it for me, a wise decision as I afterwards realized. He told her that I was still unripe for instruction, because, as she told him, I was brimming over with the novelty of heresy and had already upset a great many people. "Leave him alone," he said. "Just pray to God for him. From his own reading he will discover his mistakes and the depths of his profanity." At the same time he told her that when he was a child, his misguided mother had handed him over to the Manichees. He had not only read almost all their books, but had also made copies of them. Even though no one argued the case with him or put him right, he had seen for himself that he ought to have nothing to do with the sect, and accordingly he had left it. Even after she had heard this, my mother still would not be pacified, but persisted all the more with her tears and her entreaties that he should see me and discuss the matter. At last he grew impatient and said, "Leave me and go in peace. It cannot be that the son of these tears should be lost." In later years, as we talked together, she used to say that she accepted these words as a message from the heavens. End of book 3.